Cost-effectiveness analysis is concerned with outcomes like efficiency, value for money, or if you will, bang for the buck. These concerns are motivated by a desire to achieve the largest possible benefit, and as such, cost-effectiveness is naturally related to consequentialism, welfarism, and of course, good old utilitarianism. Should be obvious that cost-effectiveness analysis should be of interest to at least some altruists, by which I mean those concerned with the welfare of others. Cost-effectiveness analysis, beyond its merely technical expression, is a set of rules intended to maximize the size of the benefit resulting from alternative choices that we face. Let's call the project of choosing between alternatives, at least when it's based on legitimate and reasoned criteria, priority setting. So, cost-effectiveness analysis is part of priority setting, not the whole of it, perhaps, but an important and probably even a privileged part. Here, I will speak about cost-effectiveness analysis in the sphere where effectiveness is taken to be some measure of the health benefit resulting from choices. Although my focus is on cost-effectiveness analysis applied to health, because that's what I do professionally, I see no strong ethical, moral, or philosophical reasons to distinguish cost-effectiveness analysis in the health domain from cost-benefit or cost-utility analysis in health, or for that matter, to distinguish cost-effectiveness analysis in health from any of those techniques as applied to non-health areas, at least not in most of the respects that are relevant to this talk. All these methods are concerned with benefit or with the value attributed to benefit. In passing, I happen to believe that there are good reasons to claim that benefit and the value thereof are conceptually and philosophically distinct. I'll return later to the question of the differences as they apply to cost-effectiveness analysis and cost-benefit analysis. To return to the main argument, some who clearly think of themselves as consequentialists of some kind will nevertheless say that although cost-effectiveness analysis may be useful for fine-tuning choices between alternatives in rich countries, it's not important in deprived settings, where limited resources are the main constraint to doing things. They claim, therefore, that the altruist should be focused on finding more resources rather than on wasting her time and effort in choosing between things to do. I assure you that such people do exist, and that as far as I can tell, they are not made entirely of straw, since I have personally met a number of examples. While we may agree that such people are altruists, we should also agree that they certainly could never be called effective altruists. More generously, if a country spends only $30 per capita on health, but $60 is needed, efficiency gains may well not bridge the gap. More resources actually are needed. But as Dan Wickler has argued, priority setting is nevertheless required in order to know whether priority setting is insufficient. Second, priority setting is arguably most important when resources are severely limited. And finally, priority setting can increase resources by addressing the need of governments and donors to demonstrate accountability regarding the use of resources. But perhaps there's a distinction between those who claim that we should not consider benefit at all and those who claim that we should not maximize benefit apart from all other concerns. Perhaps our ineffective altruist is of the latter kind. We will come back to this question since I believe there are legitimate distinctions to be made. For now, though, let's consider the stronger view that simply by virtue of its concern for maximizing benefit, cost-effectiveness analysis, etc., should be of interest to a broad variety of consequentialists as well as to non-consequentialists who are interested in doing things, and that this interest in cost-effectiveness analysis is, or should be, uncontroversial regardless of the size of the budget we can devote to doing things. This brings us to the next key point, the budget. The budget has an ambiguous role in cost-effectiveness analysis, with some saying it's important, while others appear to ignore it completely. Since cost-effectiveness analysis is, at least in its formal expression, just a maximization problem, the budget clearly is an important feature. As the resource envelope, it puts a constraint on optimization and thereby makes the solution defined. Unconstrained optimization may be interesting in some fields, but it is not so in health or in economics. And I therefore believe that the implications of cost-effectiveness analysis, and furthermore its assumptions and its weaknesses, are rendered much more apparent when the maximization problem is posed with respect to an explicit budget constraint. That being said, those who seem to ignore the budget constraint in cost-effectiveness analysis probably also care about it in the way I have described, but they have a set of additional, more or less reasonable, assumptions that I'll discuss later. I want to clarify now that when I talk about cost-effectiveness analysis in health, it's not limited to health care. It's a truism that many activities not at all related to health care are nevertheless fundamentally related to health. So at least in principle, but also frequently in practice, these activities are of central interest to the kind of cost-effectiveness analysis I do professionally. An example includes taxation and regulation of the tobacco industry, measures to improve road traffic safety, or perhaps also water and sanitation. While there's not always a fine line between activities in the health sector and activities outside of it, it's nevertheless frequently possible to distinguish activities whose primary aim is to improve health from other activities. Another important clarification is that my kind of cost-effectiveness analysis looks at the entire set of relevant things to do, including those things that are already being done. My fundamental claim here in this talk is that this kind of cost-effectiveness analysis is the most important and useful kind, especially in developing country settings. While there may be exceptions to this rule, I believe that they are probably of minor interest to the effective altruist. If I can convince at least some of you of this claim, I'll be satisfied with this talk. At WHO, we call this latter kind of cost-effectiveness analysis generalized cost-effectiveness analysis. This is what is referred to by the label WHO choice, which is an umbrella term for a knowledge base of tools, methods, and results related to more than 500 distinct activities intended to improve health. Thus, generalized cost-effectiveness analysis is distinguished from marginal cost-effectiveness analysis, which is context-specific and hence not generalizable. Marginal cost-effectiveness analysis, also called incremental cost-effectiveness analysis, typically has no explicit budget constraint. In view of the concern of generalized cost-effectiveness analysis with the set of all things to do, the reference scenario for generalized cost-effectiveness analysis is, in fact, a counterfactual one. Namely, it is the scenario in which nothing is being done, the null scenario. As it is for marginal cost-effectiveness analysis, the intervention scenario in generalized cost-effectiveness analysis is also a counterfactual scenario. In any case, once these specifications are made, namely, we set an explicit budget constraint, we consider in principle all activities whose primary aim is improving health, and finally, we include all relevant activities and not just future ones, the maximization problem is straightforward. Marginal cost-effectiveness analysis doesn't use an explicit budget constraint because it's concerned with spending the marginal, i.e. the next dollar, on the most cost-effective option. If we are already at the benefit-maximizing position in cost-effectiveness terms, then indeed we can legitimately care only about the employment of the marginal dollar. Given this assumption, marginal cost-effectiveness analysis relies on a threshold to provide a simple decision rule for deciding whether or not to do something. If the cost-effectiveness of the activity is under the threshold, the activity should be implemented, but not otherwise. The threshold can represent some notion of social benefit, but in practice, it is usually defined by precedent, which is to say, by casuistry. In this framework, however, no one seems very concerned, in the marginal framework, that is, about the fact that many things that are over the threshold are already being done, often paid for by the government expenditure. In health, moreover, this finding is nearly universal. Yet, strangely enough, this fact is ignored or simply assumed away. One does not need to appeal to concepts like competitive markets to know that the assumption of optimality in the health sphere is false. Waste and inefficiencies abound, yet we rely on introductory economic theory to buttress an argument that does not have face validity in practice. This is a curious feature of the health community. We apparently know so little about economics that we can be fooled by the economic equivalent of snake oil salesmen. For now, I only repeat that generalized cost-effectiveness analysis alone allows one to determine the optimal portfolio of activities. Economists give this portfolio a special name. They call it the position of allocative efficiency. This means that it represents the optimal distribution of resources across activities with respect to benefit, here, health. It is worth noting, therefore, that there are only two ways of determining allocative efficiency that I know of. First, by assumption in marginal cost-effectiveness analysis, or by analysis in generalized cost-effectiveness analysis. I happen to prefer the second one. For reasons that remain unclear to me, others prefer the first. The so-called snake oil salesman, which is really my second straw man, do, however, have some powerful arguments, and I'll return to them later. Furthermore, since generalized cost-effectiveness analysis doesn't confuse the origin with the current position, generalized cost-effectiveness analysis allows one to determine the cost-effectiveness of the current portfolio of activities. It also thereby provides a measure of the distance of the current from the optimal portfolio. As a corollary, it provides a test of the hypothesis that the current is optimal, which in my experience at least has never been supported by the evidence. So with respect to this picture, that's the point I'm trying to make about the origin and the current position, where this is the cost effectiveness space and effects are on the horizontal and costs on the vertical axis. And one can quickly see that with respect to a given intervention A, you have the confounding of, if you're measuring from the current position, you have the confounding effect of what's already being done. And with respect to intervention B, typically in the marginal analysis, it won't even be considered unless it's a new activity, which would then be considered to be cost-saving. But that's a special case. And intervention B should be a general concern to us. So with respect to determining allocative efficiency, what we have here is the so-called expansion path, where interventions are simply stacked into the cost-effectiveness space with respect to their average cost-effectiveness, and then choices are made incrementally from each of them to add the next most cost-effective intervention. And there typically will be a large cloud of interventions on the interior of that surface that are not optimal. So this set of interventions, depending on where your budget line crosses horizontally, you know, where you cut across the vertical axis, this set of interventions will represent what is allocatively efficient in that setting. And just there are some call-outs on the slide, but just for the sake of context, This was done about 10 years ago. This is rather old work. And these are interventions that are contextualized to a sub-region of Africa. And these are just concerning maternal and neonatal care. And this is the same list of interventions with the figures attached, where you can see really that, you know, there are very large, even just on this short list of highly cost-effective activities, there are still rather large differences. That's just from context to flesh out the example. None of that information is important for the rest of the talk. The threshold approach might look like this. You have all of your interventions, and this happens to be work that was done at the same time, but it's including not just the maternal and neonatal work and the under fives, but also work done for the other health goals that were embodied in the MDGs. And this is in the log-log space, but other than that, you know, you can still make the threshold sort of argument by drawing your threshold in log-log space. And there's a number of different thresholds that are of interest there. One, highly cost-effective. So everything, you know, to the right and below the orange line would be considered highly cost-effective according to one arbitrary definition. Everything below the red line or near to it, if we want to take on board uncertainty, would be considered cost-effective. But other things that are farther away and to the left and above those lines may not be of interest in the threshold-based approach. But I just wanted to show that both of these approaches can be used, and that they're not perhaps as dichotomous as I suggested a few minutes ago, and we'll come back to that discussion later. So, I argue that it's important to determine explicitly the optimal portfolio, because it is, or at least it should be, an object of fundamental interest to effective altruists. I further claim that in addition to utilitarian consequentialists, those who are egalitarians and prioritarians should also care about the optimal portfolio. And I really think that all those who care about doing things, but in particular effective altruists, should care about maximizing benefit in priority setting, even those who are not motivated by consequentialist concerns. Many of these different kinds of individuals clearly care about other things too. My claim is only that they also care, or should also care, about maximizing benefit. Following work done for the WHO by a group of ethicists, philosophers, and assorted gadflies, of which we have several examples in the room, in what follows, I will use fairness to describe a collection of concerns like equity, priority for the worse off, and also procedural fairness. Given my specific context in the health sector, I may occasionally highlight this group of concerns under the single aspect of priority for the worse off. Some say that there are other legitimate health system goals that should be considered in priority setting, such as ensuring financial protection from catastrophic health care payments. I'm not hostile to these people, and WHO has explicitly embodied this concern about financial risk protection in its framework of health system goals. The goal of financial risk protection can be thought of as the claim that avoiding poverty due to one's health status should be an independent benefit provided by the health system through its financing function. Although almost everyone would prefer to be poor than dead, in practice, the trade-off is not always that stark. Note in passing that following Sen and others, poverty is not just low levels of consumption, but is a state embodying many other important deprivations. And I believe that all these other concerns can be relevant to priority setting. So there seems to be a question about the order in which concerns are relevant. also whether there is a ranking between concerns. I would claim that there is, at least to the extent that maximizing benefit, i.e. cost effectiveness, occupies a privileged position in the set of legitimate concerns. I believe I'm entitled to say this because most consequentialists, as well as most proceduralists, devote substantial attention to benefit. Thus, properly speaking, maximizing benefit factors out of priority setting as a common denominator, i.e. modulo other concerns. This is, at least in part, an empirical statement, since my view has been influenced by occasionally participating in meetings like this one for the past 15 years or so. That is, I'm fortunate in the sense that others have done the hard work of showing why all these different concerns necessarily include benefit, at least to a certain extent. I merely note here that they do in fact include benefit. So I also conclude that cost effectiveness is indeed a privileged concern for priority setting, and I would further claim that we will not often go wrong if we consider it first. I would further claim, partly in deference to Toby Ord, that it seems plausible to me that we will not often go badly wrong if we were only to consider cost effectiveness. But in what follows, I will assume that priority setting is done with respect not only to cost effectiveness, but also to a sparse list of other concerns, such as those I have previously named. Another important specification for cost effectiveness analysis is that the definition of things to do should be anchored and embedded in a specific context. This is because, in practice, someone owns the problem. For my purposes, I take the context to be that of the health system. So the set of things to do needs to be defined with respect to its embedding in the health system. I'm really not interested in the cost effectiveness of drug A or procedure B. Rather, I'm interested in the cost effectiveness of those technologies when used in a prescribed manner for specific conditions, and furthermore, considered with all the appurtenances necessary to deliver them to the recipient. Let's take the definition of health technology appearing in a resolution of the World Health Assembly. Health technology is, quote, the application of organized knowledge and skills in the form of devices, medicines, vaccines, procedures, and systems designed to solve a health problem and improve the quality of lives. I think this is a pretty good definition, one even that the ancient Greeks would probably recognize. But I would add that for our purposes, technology includes not just organized knowledge, devices, drugs, and procedures, but also their health system platform. Thus, vaccines delivered by mobile outreach units are different technology or intervention than vaccines delivered in a health center. When we perform generalized cost-effectiveness analysis at WHO, we use this sense of technology. When we combine several technologies, interventions, we often refer to the combination as a program. For example, a cancer control program usually includes prevention, screening and early detection, diagnostic, therapeutic, and palliative technologies. In WHO Choice, we include programs and subsets of programs as independent interventions. It happens to be quite important to do this because the effectiveness of an intervention, as well as its cost, happens to depend critically on whatever else is being done. Rarely does an intervention act in total isolation from the others. The effectiveness of breast cancer screening, for example, depends directly on the availability of diagnosis and treatment services. More generally, prevention and treatment also interact in terms of both cost and effect. However, incremental cost-effectiveness analysis avoids looking at this issue, since all pre-existing interventions are assumed to be fixed, and effectiveness data are obtained from settings with a similar portfolio of pre-existing activities. This simplifies the analysis, but the ceteris paribus assumption is simply not relevant to most developing country settings, where a fundamental observation, and I would argue the necessary starting point for priority setting in health, is the recognition that the coverage of many basic services is highly uneven. So for choice, we determine the optimal distribution across interventions and groups of interventions for a given budget level, and we also determine the cost effectiveness of the current portfolio of activities. In determining the optimal portfolio, we use assumptions about the coverage of interventions, about the technical efficiency of their delivery, and about the capacity utilization of their platforms that are intentionally unrealistic. This is different than the presumably unintentionally unrealistic assumption of pervasive optimality and ceteris paribus that I previously mentioned. So realism is not a value in itself, but clearly needs to be relevant to the problem at hand. I argue that our assumptions are unrealistic, but necessary with respect to the objective of determining allocative efficiency. A few further comments are relevant while discussing unrealism. In choice, we annualize costs, rather than capital costs, I might say, rather than accrue them in the year of expenditure. And we include sunk costs and other, albeit not all, costs consistent with the opportunity cost approach. Generalized cost effectiveness thus has a long-term, explicitly normative perspective. This is not the perspective in which decisions are made, but it is, I argue, a perspective that is, or at least should be, highly relevant to decision-making. As noted, the main purpose of generalized cost-effectiveness analysis is to define the position of allocative efficiency, and as a corollary, the distance of the current position from optimality. Some will object, but this is not the actual problem faced by decision makers. They may add, decision makers do not always appeal to legitimate social goals in making decisions. They also often say decision makers make changes at the margin, therefore priority setting should be done at the margin. There are good reasons to say nearly all of these things, but the conclusion that priority setting should be done at the margin represents a serious error. The error is roughly equivalent to pretending that time does not exist. In other words, that conclusion might be valid if decision-making, rather, was a one-off exercise, never to be repeated. Yet it is not a once-and-done affair, and it's institutionalized in many settings. So to reach the conclusion that priority setting, as distinct from decision-making, needs to adopt a marginal perspective because decisions are made at the margin is somewhat like pretending there's no past and no future. Rather than adopt such a bizarre construct, I argue that priority setting is not identical to the process of decision-making, nor coterminous with it. Decision-making is prospective, but priority setting is necessarily not so. I believe that for all sorts of people who have consequentialists and or procedural concerns, decision-making should be informed by priority setting, even if it is not fully determined by it. Furthermore, those who say that decision-making is done at the margin, and therefore priority setting should also be, are generally from developed countries with established health systems. In other settings, however, big bang policy questions, ones that throw every ball up into the air, are not unknown. For example, in Pakistan, a decision has recently been made to develop a national health insurance, and the authorities are, as we speak, struggling to determine what package of interventions should be covered. This is a highly non-marginal question. Priority setting of the kind I embrace, I thought I saw your hand, is thus necessarily concerned with past decisions affecting existing activities, as much as it is concerned with current decisions affecting future activities. Decision-making, on the other hand, is mainly, if not exclusively, concerned with deciding on future activities. Still, as long as we are one of those people who care about maximizing benefit, I believe we're obliged to care about both past and future activities when we do priority setting. Decision makers may be concerned with future consequences, but defective altruists should be impartial with respect to time. I have argued that nearly all types of effective altruists should care about maximizing benefit, at least to some extent, and I've also made the case that their concern should be an important and not merely a minor one. Some may still reply, "This is true, but in practice, decision makers rarely can consider disinvesting in activities resulting from past decisions, such as closing down expensive dialysis centers." I note that dialysis is a favorite example. To reply, I would only note that in the long run, I believe we're all disinvested. I moreover believe that the perspective of priority setting needs to be that of the long run, because we need to be concerned with the best possible choices and not merely with the best choices contingent on past decisions. Concern with contingent choices is the legitimate domain of decision making, but for decision making to be rational in any of the senses that I've described, it needs to take account of priority setting, and it needs to do so explicitly. The rationalist version of decision making might set the following question: given a set of priorities and given a set of current activities, how can we organize our actions so that over time our activities best support our priorities? Recall that priorities include not just the size of the benefit, but also fairness and so forth. I believe that any version of decision making that doesn't take into account priorities defined in this way can only properly be called expedient. That may, in fact, be the actual version of decision-making in many settings. But as effective altruists, our task really is to confront expediency with a rationalist discourse. I'll not expand here about governance, accountability for reasonableness, and transparency, but I will nevertheless claim that I believe that expediency is faced with a very different public relations problem in the presence of a coherent rationalist discourse. So part of our job as effective altruists is to make sure that such a discourse exists and that it is as reasonable and coherent as we can make it. Part of this task also means that we have to think carefully about how to communicate this discourse to the public and to other actors, such as policymakers. And in passing, with respect to that communication problem, I'm not personally convinced we've given it sufficient attention. But to back up slightly, it appears that something as simple as acknowledging the time dimension of collective human activity is a sufficient move to allow priority setting to make direct contact with real-world decision-making, and that this provides an opening for the effective altruist to influence the messy political economy of the real world. In the health sector, we refer to decision-making of this kind, that is, when it's considered as part of a process that includes priority setting, we might refer to that kind of decision-making as strategic planning. In particular, We refer to it in this way when we assume that the priority setting work has been done and has yielded an explicit set of objectives for the decision-making process. Another convenient reason we use that term is that in many countries of the world, so-called strategic plans are produced every 5 years or so by the Department of Planning in the Ministry of Health as a requirement of law. Strategic planning, therefore, provides an entry point for priority setting in the framework of institutions, by which I mean the set of rules or laws governing human activity. A strategic plan is a decision-making tool, yet it exists at a higher level of generalization than a budget, by which I here understand a prospective planning tool, and not as the resource envelope I described earlier. It also exists at a higher level of generalization than an operational plan. Nevertheless, as a decision-making tool, a strategic plan legitimately considers only marginal costs and benefits. Sunk costs are properly ignored, and future costs are not annualized, but they are accrued in the year of expenditure. Benefits in this setting reflect actual or target coverage rather than an idealized coverage. Strategic planning can adopt this perspective because its objectives have already been determined through priority setting. Any other procedure for establishing objectives simply would not be strategic. Nor, I might add, would those objects properly be called objectives. Thus, I believe that part of the debate between the marginal and the long run, or in my terms, the generalized perspective in priority setting, is based on a simple confusion about the question under consideration. In practice, strategic planning might proceed by examining two portfolios of activities, the benefit-maximizing one and the current one. It might then, given this setup, a natural question is, how much of the variation between the first and the second one can be explained by appealing to fairness, priority to the worse off, financial risk protection, and other legitimate goals? This question can be answered quantitatively, or it can be answered through deliberative dialogue, but in any case, it can be answered. And once it has been answered, eliminating the residual unexplained difference between number one, the first and the second portfolio, becomes really the goal for strategic planning. So here I have a picture where you have, in principle, a distribution of activities. The size of the circles, the pies, you know, might represent the budget or what have you. But you can see that there's the current set and there's the allocatively efficient set. And strategic planning and priority setting, rather the priority setting part of strategic planning, is really about saying, how do we get from here to there? After we've explained, in other words, why are we at that current position, and why are there differences? And I think that particular setup provides a particularly clear frame for that question, because it begs the question of why are there differences. And if we can't explain those differences, then that's legitimately something we should be striving to eliminate. So we can explain the variation by appealing to fairness, by appealing to priority for the worse off, or by the provision of financial protection, or other legitimate health system goals. And I think in any of the cases that we can imagine, we can at least put bounds on that question of how much of that variance we can explain. Let's see here. A few other remarks, and then I'm going to go into some other issues. We have some more time. The residual part would probably be due to factors like budgetary inertia, political compromise, or just random irrationality. It's quite a lot of that, actually. And it also provides a very clear frame for the question, are there easy wins, things we clearly should be doing more or less of? And it does that in a time perspective that is a kind of repeated prisoner's dilemma. It takes some of the edge off the one-off version. So that role of strategic planning, you know, is to put it in a context of from theory to practice. There's the old computer science joke that in theory and practice are the same, but of course in practice they're different. But the fact that we have that observation doesn't somehow weaken the force of trying to, doesn't mean we abandon theory. And that's essentially what the marginal project is about. It's saying we need to abandon the theory and we need to deal with the actual situation of practice. And I think that is a situation in which both sides lose. So, yeah, I think I've said all of this. That's just a picture you can contemplate. A few loose ends. Let me get right into what I think is the more interesting one, which is discounting. I had a rather nice technical discussion of the causes of disease that I was rather proud of, but I'll save that for the paper. Discounting. Well, I do have to say at least this much. When we start cost-effectiveness analysis, we start with a descriptive list of causes of disease. We start with a picture that's provided by the burden of disease of what's happening with respect to health in a setting. And you know, hence the picture. The difference in the quantity of health between the intervention scenario as compared to the reference scenario is what we call the measure of effectiveness in cost-effectiveness. And we compare that measure of effectiveness to the cost of the inputs that are required to bring it about to get the cost-effectiveness ratio. So that is just necessary to set up the following statement. We should not use discounting in the measure of the burden of disease. In the first place, we should not use discounting because when we measure health, we measure only the quantity, let's call it Q, of a certain kind of benefit. Discounting should not be applied to quantities. It should be applied to values. In order to map a quantity to a value, we need what economists call a price. Although Toby has invented a different word for it, which I was rather gratified to hear. But a price, in the sense that economists use it, is really just a numeraire of value in some unit of account. So when we get the price of health multiplied by its quantity, in other words, P times Q, then we have what we can call the value of health. And occasionally, as we do, when we have a stream of values in time, it might be, but is not always, relevant to compare the whole stream at a moment in time. In other words, net present value. In such a case, discounting may be relevant, but not otherwise. Yet, let's talk about the price. We don't buy health, and we don't vote on it, so we don't have a market price for it. If we want to value it, we need to estimate what economists call a shadow price. Now, as problematic as the measurement of health, i.e. Q, as problematic as the measurement of Q may be, it is almost certainly not as problematic as the measurement of its shadow price. So, if we restrict our domain to the sphere of health, then it's probably preferable to consider health in its own terms. After all, we're not concerned within the health system in trading off health against other kinds of benefit, except perhaps financial risk protection. Within the health system, we should be concerned with maximizing health while pursuing other legitimate goals. And I believe this explains why cost-effectiveness analysis is popular with the public health community. It offers a coherent measure of benefit while sidestepping the thorny problems involved with the valuation of health. One may claim that the so-called disability weights, which are important for calculating the burden of disease, are in fact a measure of value. And I would grant that here the case is more nuanced, yet I take the view, in common with the authors of the latest estimates, that disability weights are properly understood as measures of the quantity of health lost due to non-fatal outcomes. So measures of the quantity of benefit attributable to interventions, such as those derived from cost-effectiveness analysis, should likewise be viewed as reflecting only the quantity and not the value of the health gained. That being said, there's an important sense in which priority setting does need to take account of values. I happen to think that it needs to do so whenever the domain is not restricted to health. This situation arises, as it indeed does quite frequently, when the health sector needs to argue for a greater share of, say, the government expenditure, or when stakeholders in the health sector need to develop multi-sectoral plans to combat non-communicable diseases, for example. When health officials propose to put taxes on alcohol or on cigarettes, they also have started, at least in principle, to think about trading off different kinds of benefit. So to do this, we need a common numerator of value. And the perspective that allows for the comparison of these different kinds of benefits is social cost-benefit analysis. So if one has to compare different benefits by using a common measure of value, then I think we need to be resigned to push through the difficulties involved in valuing health, while nevertheless being careful to sequester those difficulties in the proper part of the problem. We should factor the problem in a sensible way so that the difficulties are piled up where they belong and are not in the parts of the problem that are non-controversial. Now, that being said, the health community has not traditionally been open to the project of comparing different kinds of benefit. Yet, this is necessarily changing. In a globalizing world, where the convergence of spheres is a common theme, pushing our discourse beyond health and into a common domain that includes other important benefits is an increasing concern for the global health community. At the institutional level, one area in which the rule of convergence can be seen to apply is in the formulation of the post-2015 Sustainable Development Goals, which will soon succeed the Millennium Development Goals. As an aside, or perhaps even an exaggeration, my impression is that for the past 15 years, the health community would usually ignore the fact that the Millennium Development Goals also included goals not formulated in terms of health. So, as surprised as we were with our seemingly undeserved good fortune to find health suddenly on the agenda, our corresponding fear with the Sustainable Development Goals is that health might now somehow and just as suddenly disappear. I believe, however, that we should not be afraid of the Sustainable Development Goals because health is an essential component of whatever we could possibly mean by development, and more particularly by sustainable development. It was not an accident that health wound up in the MDGs, nor is it a possibility that health would be ignored in the SDGs. But more broadly, for the health community, health parochialism is no longer a safe haven. And the health agenda now needs increasingly to be inscribed within a coherent theory of human well-being. I think I'll stop there. I have some...